talk to SI-110 because you literally can talk about anything in SI-110. There's really nothing you can't talk about. So it gives me the chance to talk about whatever I feel like. And so today I'm going to give you the fractured fairy tale history of the internet. And you probably know the history of the internet kind of in a non-fractured fairy tale that some daring heroes created this cool thing and then they conquered the world, the end, right? And so when we look back at history, we often see what I call kind of the hero syndrome, where we sort of claim that one real great genius figured it out and did it all, and then we just all followed. It's sort of like why, you know, we organize ourselves in the military, because we want a leader. We want to believe that there is the one true leader. So that's kind of like the traditional history of the internet. And this is the fractured fairy tale history of the internet, in that it talks about why the internet almost didn't happen, why the web almost didn't happen, why the Apple iPhone almost didn't happen, and how close we were to a very different future where maybe you wouldn't all be sitting here with amazing technology on your laps. And so we're going to go back in history. Oh, got to turn the thing on. Yeah. Turn the thing on. Turn the thing on. Turn the thing on. Here comes the thing. Okay. Now I have a deep voice. I am Oz, the great and terrible. So basically we'll go back and we'll look at some of the people and introduce you to those people and mic down a little bit. Introduce you to those people and get you a sense of who it was that actually created this internet. And what they're actually trying to do, in a way very few of them really anticipated the world we would have today, they were actually trying to solve rather narrow problems. And inadvertently, they stumbled on amazing technologies. So before we go into the lecture, just a little bit about myself. How many of you have used CTools? So I was the chief architect of a Sakai project from 2004 through 2007, which built the software called Sakai that CTools is based on. I wrote a book about all the people that pissed me off during that period of time, although I was kind of gentle to those people. I'm probably the only person up here that has a tattoo. That's a real tattoo. It's not just Photoshop. I have a tattoo of Sakai, the software that powers CTools, sitting here on this very shoulder under this pink shirt. I'm not going to show you because I have to take all my clothes off, so I won't show you. But I teach another class in the School of Information, the undergraduate level. Often students who take SI-110 come and take SI-124. It's a winter class. It's a class called Network Thinking, where we sort of understand viral videos and how people convince each other why it is that the iPhone and iPod are the only music players on the planet left. They killed all the other ones. How groups think, etc. One of the things that we do in this class, it's a lot of fun, is we have a contest in the class to build the best viral video as a student project. Now, there's a couple rules to this. There can be no nudity in the viral video, and you're not allowed to put your roommate in a shopping cart and push him down a hill. As funny as that might be, we don't allow it. So we don't allow any danger to the participants. And so I'll show you the video that I made kind of as a demonstration of what we do in this class. So this was my contribution to this video. Has anyone ever, has anyone seen the iPad steering wheel mount video yet? One person has seen the iPad steering wheel mount video. So I've made more money on the iPad steering wheel mount video than I have on my book. Okay. Now that doesn't mean I made a lot. I've made like $60 on my book and like $300 on the video. But this was my sort of demonstration as a possible. So welcome to our demonstration drive, the iPad steering wheel mount. We'll demonstrate this with our USA Today application. I think this is a great enhancement to safety so that you don't have to text with something that's down in your console, or you can take your eyes off the steering wheel and use your normal radio. And so what this is a steering wheel mounted iPad, and it's very easy to get on and off. I won't show you the details of the mount because you have to pay for the plans. So the key is that you can drive
And you can do things like read or select music, and you're absolutely not distracted in any way from the road. I mean, you look down, but you look up. It's almost like a heads-up display on the vehicle. And so it's much safer than other forms of in-car electronics, in my opinion. And so that's why I've developed this patented iPad steering wheel mount. So let's take it for a little drive. So here we go. We'll take off, and you'll notice as I turn, it maintains the upwardness, and you really probably shouldn't be reading on a turn anyways, and you get to see how it works while the vehicle's moving. So again, I think that as I come to a stop, as my closed course ends, I think that you'll find that this iPad steering wheel mount is much safer than other forms of in-car driver distraction.
So if you go look at my video on YouTube, you will read the comments and you will find that people from outside the United States and English-speaking countries like New Zealand and England and Australia just don't have a very good sense of humor. They don't get the humor in that, and it's really kind of fun to watch them go through therapeutic moments as they think that that's a serious thing coming from America, right? And so they're very critical of the person doing it, and they're very critical of the country from which this person is coming from. But I think it's probably good for them at the end of the day. Now, that was, until last week, the reigning champion of viral videos coming from SI-124. The teacher made the most viral video. Until this happened 2 weeks ago. Did anyone see this? Well, we'll see. You'll see. Maybe you don't know what it's going to be yet. So let's do this one. Now, we actually had some more intellectual videos than this. But part of viral video is figuring out what will go viral. And they made it to Tosh.0, which I think is a good indication. The interesting study that I wish we were doing in other class is the moment this ends up on Tosh, the number of imitation videos just skyrockets, right? As soon as Tosh creates the phrase, pie, whatever, nut, whatever, bitch, whatever. Once that phrase becomes a phrase that people type, there's a million of these things all of a sudden. So be careful, right, as you walk into rooms from this point forward. For the next couple of weeks, there's sort of this phenomenon of sort of imitation of videos. Once a web search term becomes hot for a week or so, then all of a sudden people are putting this stuff up to try to steal the traffic where they're really looking for the video. And that was, I think they were three business majors. They actually worked really hard on the project, and they did a whole series of pranks where they had multiple cameras. They were doing things where laptops would play improper videos at the wrong time in the library, and they're trying to catch people. They just never got the timing right. They had all these cameras, and they worked so hard, and this was kind of like, well, we're screwed. None of our stuff worked out. And so they just kind of like came up with this really stupid one, and of course, it worked. It tells you something about human nature. So that is my little ad for SI-124. It's a lot of fun class, and we do serious stuff and have exams in addition to videos. And I hope you don't just take the class and then do the exact same video. So the idea of Fractured Fairy Tales, for those of you who don't know, it was a part of this Rocky and Bullwinkle show, which seemed like a children's show, but really was a grown-up show, and so children would see it from a children's perspective, and there was all these like hidden digs and secret things in Rocky and Bullwinkle. And they would always take these fairy tales and sort of like spin them on their ear. And so this is my Fractured Fairy Tale history of the internet. And so what I'm going to talk about is basically three important moments in the history of the internet. So there was the first national network, the network of basically seven nodes that was national. It was the first open network that moved data back and forth like the internet that you're using today. What if that didn't happen? What if the World Wide Web was never created at CERN? And then the Mosaic web browser, which probably you know less about, which is the first commercially, it was the first web browser that worked outside of a high-end Unix environment on Macs and PCs, which were the personal computers of the time. And so this, so what happened was is that this really was a research project that escaped into sort of a commercial world. And we'll look at the moments where it sort of did this escaping. So I'm first going to show you an ad. And I want you to, on a little piece of paper, or at least in your mind, guess what year this ad was produced and what company produced the ad. Hopefully you didn't notice that. So the question, if you didn't notice, I have to fix that part. I forgot to cover that. So if you didn't see it, try to imagine what year that was produced and what company produced it. Okay, we'll come back to that. So in the web was sort of created in 1990. And in 1995, I was at Michigan State University, and I was on the faculty there. And one of the things that I was approached by TCI Cable Company, which no longer exists, having been eaten by AT&T later, to host a television show on the internet. We were creating this show that was it was basically product placement for cable modems. Cable modems were a new technology in the mid 90s, and they wanted to sort of get people to the point where they thought that they were safe and understandable. And so we had this television program that was a talk show about the internet. And in this program, we would have this cable modem. It was product placement. And we would kind of like and see how fast our network connection is because of this awesome cable modem. And so we would talk about the cable modem all the time. But the neat thing was they sent this program around the country, and it was the first national television program produced about the internet. Now, a year later, things like Tech TV existed and other things, and there were weekly national programs, and our little monthly sort of sophomoric production was no longer really that relevant because we were just having a good time and this cable company was paying for it, and it was so fun. But for me personally, it was a great opportunity, and the videos that you'll see today are because I had this television program, and I would go walk up to these people back when the internet was really tiny and stick a camera in their face. And I would say, hey, I have a television program, will you talk to me? And everything was pretty small and it was very intimate, and so people would say yes. So I'll start and show you a short video from that show from Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the internet. The co-inventor. This is my co-host, Rich Wiggins.
Last month, I was off in Boston for the 4th Annual World Wide Web Conference, and I had the opportunity to talk to the inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, and I asked him a little bit about where are we going with this web stuff, and we had just a little bit of footage from Tim telling us where that's going to be.
You didn't see nothing yet, but you wait until people see the web. The web that comes in, you can see them. When the infrastructure is all laid down, we have an information space, then it will be time for the next revolution. Who knows what that will be?
It's hard to imagine a greater revolution than what we're seeing. I mean, I go to the smallest places and everybody's going around and doing it.
Right. The web could only take place, the revolution could only take place because of the internet. We should be a quieter, smaller revolution, but that is the internet itself, marching, being deployed throughout the world.
Pretty neat, Rich. One of the things that I liked about it was he just said his idea was the next step is something completely different, cultural revolution, as compared to just a little more technology.
So So that was taped in late 1994, and so you can imagine that, like Tim Berners-Lee was predicting in some sense without knowing it, some of the recent events, even in the past year, of how the internet is just profoundly changing how the world thinks about itself. And whether you can debate whether or not some of the recent revolutions were fueled by the internet or not, that's a fun debate to have. There's no question that the mindset that leads to people desiring more freedom is greatly enhanced by the internet and the ability to see the world outside whatever the controlled environment that you happen to be in. And so I think Tim Berners-Lee was right on when in the mid-90s he predicted that this isn't just about technology, this is just about changing society and changing society for better. So for him it wasn't just, it wasn't about technology. So another in that same show, another talk changed my life forever. This is from Real Audio, and so if you listen here, he'll talk about the fact that at this point in time there are 700,000 people that can listen to audio over the internet. As far as he was concerned, this was a pretty amazing thing that 700,000 people could listen to audio.
And we have over 700,000 people who have downloaded Player in the last 6 months at a rate of about 250,000 a month. So if you just do the arithmetic, you would imagine that over the next 6 months, there would be many millions of people listening and tens of thousands of people producing. It allows the idea of what we call narrowcasting. That is to take information in a very inexpensive way and get it to very specific points of interest and targets. Another large user of Real Audio is education. Now, distance learning, the ability to provide a learning environment over time and over space.
So that video was taped in West Hall, right here in Ann Arbor. That was one of the founders of the Real Audio back when you had 28.8 modems and audio was the only thing we could stream over the internet. And just listening to that sitting, because I didn't tape that, but I saw it in the studio when we were making the television show, that sort of caused me to decide to change my own personal research from what was then high-performance computing and supercomputers to teaching and learning on the internet, and that's been my research area ever since. And so sort of it's a pretty profound effect on me personally. But again, most of you were rather young at the point in the mid-90s when all this was happening, but we were doing it all for you, right? We were sort of building all this up, anticipating your arrival and anticipating your needs. But what I'm showing you there is sort of mid-90s. Let's go back a little bit. Because as Tim Berners-Lee mentioned, there was a quieter revolution that happened before the web revolution, and that was the internet revolution. The internet revolution formed the basis for the web revolution. The internet revolution actually had another revolution even before that, and that was a revolution that came really from the United States military, the Defense DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects, something or other, and they paid a lot of money to a lot of really smart computer scientists to build this network with the idea of making the network resilient to failure. Because in the 60s, everyone was kind of worried about maintaining communications as sort of nuclear missiles came flying across. We've seen actually situations where the internet's gone down in countries, and it wasn't, the internet can handle nuclear missiles, but what the internet can't handle is a person walking into a room and unplugging everything, right? And so when the government has control of the room, the government can unplug everything, as they did in Egypt for a while. And so here's something that was designed to handle nuclear hits, and yet just a person who just has the key to the building and unplugs all the equipment making the connection. Now, the whole internet didn't go down, just Egypt went down for a little while. And so in the 1960s through the 1980s, this research was done as a military grant. Now, we see a lot of characterization of military grants in the movies. And what you see is some general that walks in with a chest full of medals and some gray-haired professor with some spectacles, and the general says, "Where is my killer robot? I need to do something with the killer robot. kill some people in a foreign country or whatever it is we do with killer robots. I have given you millions over these years, and I still need my killer robot, and I want my killer robot next week, or I'm never going to give you any money ever again, and I'm going to tell everybody I know never to give you any money. And the professor's like all a flutter, and then the professor's attractive young daughter gets kidnapped by people, and then the movie progresses, right? And in a way, the way the U.S. Department of Defense gives money is kind of like that. They give money to people they believe in, and they give them a lot of money. And if they get ticked off at them, they kind of take their money away. It's a very market-driven thing. And so these people that built these first early networks were extremely well-funded. And as long as they keep their military funders happy, the cash just kept coming in. So these folks had a great time. It was a rather exclusive club. A few computer science departments, you can see like MIT, Bolt, Barrington, Newman, University College London, Stanford Research Institute, Fort Bragg. Not a lot of, you know, there's not, it was just whoever was in the club got money, and they got a lot of it. And the idea that they were trying to understand is that in those days we would make sort of long distance connections using the phone company and pay a lot for these long distance connections. What these folks were doing was leasing the long distance connections permanently and trying to find a way for lots of computers around the edge to move data in a shared way. And the trick that they invented was what are called packets. And so they would break each long message. Instead of sending one message after the other, they would break every message into pieces and send a piece of the first message, the second message, the third message, and then they would go back and they would share all these long connections that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to connect across the country. So their fundamental research was asking the question, how can hundreds of computers share a very few long distance links and yet make it seem like everything is moving rather quickly? So we're all sharing kind of the same network bandwidth, the same wireless in this room, and yet for each of us, unless we do something crazy like everyone starts streaming video at the same time, it just seems like it's instantaneous for all of us. And that's what they were researching, the notion of one shared medium with many computers, and then dealing with the fact that there might be an outage and how to route around that outage, how to detect the problem and route around it and deal with it. And that's what they were researching in a rather closed environment for 20 years. And it was kind of cool because over that 20 years, you might say, well, that's kind of unethical that they got all this cash from the military and they didn't have any kind of competition or open discussion as to who should get the money. But what was cool is because they had consistent funding, they could actually try an idea, throw it away, and get more money to do another idea. So there's actually a number of iterations where they had sort of slowly but surely refined their technology in a 20-year period with a lot of investment by the government. So, what happened to take this 10 to 20 university plus some military bases technology and put it in this room and make it part of our everyday life? Well, first we're going to visit the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we are going to talk about supercomputers. So one of the things that was happening in the 90s was that science was starting to use technology to accelerate itself. Supercomputers, high-performance computing, weather simulations, this, that, and the other thing. So scientists needed faster and faster and faster computers. And so if you were a physicist and you wanted to do better research, you would go get a $4 million computer. And then a biologist at a different university said, I need it, and so I need a $4 million computer. Some of these are $20 million computers. I think that was about a $20 million computer right there that's less powerful than most of your cell phones today. But that was pretty awesome in the day, right? And so we had these computers, and the problem was is all these faculty members, we couldn't buy one for every faculty member because it was like a couple of million bucks for every one of them. And so they had to come up with a way to put them centrally and share them. And the problem was is they couldn't share them centrally until they had a network. And so the supercomputers became the excuse for making a network. So now we'll meet Larry Smarr, who is the director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he really is seen as sort of like the... There were many schools that were involved in the supercomputer centers, but Larry Smarr kind of towered above everybody because he was a really good communicator. He could explain why it was that the U.S. government should spend millions of dollars on making physics better or making biology better. And it was not easy to convince the federal government or anyone else that you should spend money on these kinds of things. So let's meet Larry.
I mean, you gotta understand, the world was totally different when the Supercomputer Center's program was coming into being. And people, it's so hard for people now on the web and everything to go back to that time. There was no internet. You know, there was these wonderful...
This was taped in 1997. So he's talking about how crazy it was in 1997, how people don't remember history.
People, Ben Cerf and Bob Kahn, all these people, Bill Joy, who had developed TCP/IP and embodied it in the ARPANET. There's a few computer science departments and military, okay? Nobody in the physics department or chemistry department ever heard of the ARPANET, much less had any access to it. But it was obviously the right idea. And so once we got the Congress to put through money for a national supercomputer program, then there was a national competition and so on, and the five centers were selected. The first thing then the NSF realized, well, okay, now we put these in place to be providing access to academic scientists, and yet, like, they have to fly to Champaign-Urbana, like I had to fly to Livermore, okay? This isn't right. So there were a lot of discussions then, but the trouble was that the telecom lobbyist in Washington would block any discussion of the federal government putting in the kind of network we have today, which is what people wanted. I mean, everybody knew that they wanted to have a ubiquitous email, person-to-person network. But as soon as they'd start talking about that, the telecom lobbyists would come up and say, no way, guys, that's private sector. Don't get the federal government involved in that. Stay out of it. But we said, oh, we'll just take a few of these esoteric supercomputers. And they said, okay, that's right. There's no market there. That's okay. The federal government has a role. Well, the same thing with networking. What we said is, we just want to put a high-speed backbone across the country to connect the five centers. And the telecom people said, okay, that's cool. You know, 56 kilobits was the national high-speed backbone, less than ISDN today. Yeah, that's not a market, okay? And we said, we got a few of these weird supercomputer types who are out in universities who want to hook into that. And say, yeah, that's okay, that's not a market. You can do that. Well, that was the NSF net backbone. Then the regionals got funded, and then the campuses were afraid that if they didn't dig up their quad and put in some fiber, then the professors who wanted to get access to supercomputers would go to a university that would do that. So gradually, the whole internet emerged out of the sort of policy advice you get into Washington, where you can't do the right thing. You have to do something that seems irrelevant, but has a logic to it that will gradually bring the market forces into play that will spin out ultimately a whole industry.
So if you're listening closely, can you figure out like who the bad guy was during this 1980, 81, 82 time frame where they were trying to convince folks to let them build a national internet that would be shared by everybody? Who's the bad guy? Telecom lobbyists. That's a good thing. Anytime the word lobbyist is used, it's kind of a trigger to say bad guy, right? Somebody or some organization that has some financial gain. So what they were trying to do is they were trying to protect their monopolistic position in data communications, right? And they did not want sort of this to happen. But as Larry mentions, they just said, look, it's just a bunch of crazy long-haired physicists anyways. I mean, they're not dangerous to big telecommunications, and so we sneaked it in under, and you'll notice he talked about the speed of the network, 56 kilobits. Now, 56 kilobits is like the, if you remember the Apple One, and then like the Apple, the iPhone One, and iPhone 2, and the iPhone 3GS, and then iPhone 4. So if you go back to the Apple One, that speed, that edge speed, the one that you get really angry when you see the E on your cell phone, the edge speed is 128 kilobits, which was twice as fast as the national network, meaning moving data from Michigan to California was half as fast as edge. And that was the only connection. It wasn't like there was a bunch of other connections. There was like going to be one connection, and that single connection for the entire country was half as fast as Edge on your... Now you can kind of understand why the telecommunications lobbyists thought, huh, that's going to fail. So, as Larry mentioned, in the late 80s, the supercomputer centers were funded, and they put $10 to $20 million supercomputer centers in 7 schools around the country. And then there was the task of building the network. And in the building of the network, the University of Michigan becomes involved. So now we're going to meet Doug Van Holling, who in 1985 was the chief information officer at the University of Michigan, having recently come from Carnegie Mellon University, where he'd had a really good relationship with the IBM Corporation. And the University of Michigan wanted to get one of these supercomputer centers. Everybody did. It was like the feather in your cap, research-wise. And we made a strategic mistake at the University of Michigan in choosing a Japanese-built computer rather than an American-built computer. And so we kind of got skunked on the supercomputer deal. And so Doug decided that what we should do instead of trying to get a supercomputer would get the network as kind of like the secondary prize. And so the problem was, is the University of Michigan was not well respected in the network community. At least they were never a member of those ARPANET. If you go back to that slide I showed before, the University of Michigan was not on there. Very few universities were, but University of Michigan was not one of them. So we were the underdog in this particular situation. So let's meet Doug and find out a little bit about how the underdog actually won. And you'll notice our villain shows up again in this video.
We realized very rapidly that $50 million would only fund a 56 kilobit network, which it was very clear, if it were even put in place, would rapidly become overwhelmed by the traffic. So we immediately started thinking, well, how could we expand the envelope? So we got tentatively an agreement from IBM that they would contribute the hardware and the software to create the routing structure for the network. But we still needed the communications facilities. Well, as you may recall, at that time, UCI was this fledgling organization. Some people had described it really as a law office trying to create an environment where they could actually offer telecommunications services up against AT&T's lobbying efforts. And they had just been successful in that. They were establishing facilities across the United States. And Dick Liebhaber saw this as an opportunity to sort of move MCI into the big time. So we wound up being able to submit a proposal to the National Science Foundation, I think for something like $14.7 million, because we knew the ceiling was 15. But in fact, by including all this in-kind activity, it was actually more like a $55 million proposal. And it wasn't designed to be 56 kilobits. It was designed to start at T1, or 1.5 megabits, with planned upgrades over the period of the network's life. We subsequently learned that the proposal was received with considerable skepticism by the reviewers of the National Science Foundation, because Merritt did not have a strong history in TCP/IP, and IBM was thought of as the enemy of the internet. It was then focused on its own proprietary protocols, and so people really wondered about our technical ability to pull this off. But that review was conducted without reference to the actual funding pattern. And then when the wraps got pulled off of the amount of resource that was being committed by the partners to this proposal, it immediately went to the top of the list.
So basically, I don't know this for a fact, but you could imagine that in Congress, when they were authorizing the network to run for 5 years from 1985 to 1990, they carefully calculated the cost so that they would cripple it from its very inception, so that it would, the only way, if you were to buy the lines from AT&T and use the hardware that was traditionally used in ARPANET, it would cost exactly $15 million. And that's as much as they would give, because Congress and the lobbyists wanted it to die, wanted it to fail. They couldn't say, no, you can't do it, but they wanted to allow the academic world to do something that would fail and prove that we, the academic world, were incapable of doing this kind of data networking, and we should leave this to the real professionals at the telecommunications companies. So what Michigan did was convinced IBM, who was not the expected company to provide the hardware, to provide the hardware and software for free, convinced MCI, which of course no longer exists, right about that same time was the breakup of AT&T and the creation of MCI and Sprint and all these other long distance carriers to compete. This was kind of a messy time. Everybody was confused. So Doug and folks here at Michigan went to MCI and said, look, you guys are upstarts. You're all mavericks. No one will trust you. No one would pay you to do this. So what you should do for great glory is just give us this free. Not only give us free 56K kilobits, but give us free 1.5 megabits, later to go to 45 megabits. And MCI had nothing to lose, right? They were just trying to, you know, find a way into the marketplace and create a brand up against AT&T. And so basically, the unlike all the rest of the proposals looked like clones of one another. They bought the exact same hardware, they rented the exact same lines, and they all come up around $15 million. This proposal, the state of Michigan threw $1 million in the, per year as well. This proposal was basically for a real awesome network at $15 million, except that there was like $40 million of free stuff from MCI, IBM, and the state of Michigan. So we won. University of Michigan won this. And the interesting thing is that the moment, if you the way the National Science Foundation chooses is a very kind of closed process. A bunch of geniuses get in a room, peer review is what it's called, and we pick them. The interesting thing is the moment that Doug talks about where they were picking the Michigan proposal, there would be no lobbyists in the room, right? So at the moment where the money was being authorized, there might be lobbyists in the room, and they would carefully craft how much would be authorized. But as Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park, nature found a way. $15 million came out, but $55 million came back in. Okay? And so nature found a way to get past the lobbyists who tried to limit this thing and make it fail. They carefully conspired to make it fail. Ooh, we already saw that one. I hope I didn't screw that up. We'll see. So the National Science Foundation network was operated at Michigan. Michigan didn't have a supercomputer. Michigan had never participated in the ARPANET. And yet, culturally, we were the kind of organization that would see beyond what was just being handed to us, but see beyond that and try to open the, as Doug say, sort of look beyond the instructions that were given and see it differently. So the National Science Foundation, first NSFNet that started as Doug said, with 1.54 megabits a second, was run out of that building right there, which is on North Campus. It's sort of across from the VA hospital. That was the first place. That was the first building I touched the internet, where I walked in that building, and I touched the internet for the first time in that building here on this campus. And the thing grew like crazy. It was sort of like a virus. Once it had escaped, it just infected and infected. And as Larry said in an earlier talk, it just became the thing that campuses had to do. Build a campus network. Connect yourself to the internet. It was an Oklahoma land rush for universities to get connected. And so the growth of the internet from the moment in 85 when this thing started through 90 was outrageous. They extended it a couple of more years into the early 90s, at which point the private sector took over running all of it. So it was the first sort of person-to-person network that was inclusive. The ARPANET was a very similar technology, but it was exclusive. It was only to those people who were funded for the research on the networks themselves. It standardized on a protocol at that point, which is called TCP/IP. Now we just assume this is a great idea. But back then, there was all this research going on about what network protocol should be the right one to build a national network. Thankfully, the previous 20 years of research from the 1960s to the 1980s of ARPANET had worked through a lot of the technical difficulties of building and running such a network at moderate scale with several hundreds of hosts. We have, you know, millions and millions of hosts right now. And thankfully, that protocol is still held up pretty well. But it was because of 20 years of research investment by the US federal government. So in the early 90s, it became possible to sort of just have citizens rather than just academics on the network. Cell dial-up service, America Online, started switching from its own dial-up to starting to use the internet. And so it really became a commercial spot in the early 1990s. And so this is a picture of sort of like the National Science Foundation. The backbone is the white things at the top, and then the regionals, and then the campuses. And this is sort of giving a sense of the kind of the connectivity. And of course, today, that's sort of a rather early picture of the topology of the national network. That was probably sort of around 1991, right. I was going to say, just from the density of that, it looks like it's about 1990. So we've gone from University of Illinois and Urbana-Champaign, where the supercomputers were sort of a breakthrough idea, and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign was critical in causing the grant to come out. You may have heard Al Gore laughed at as if he said, which he never did, of course, said, "I invented the internet," which he never said. It was just kind of mean people that sort of misread it. What Al Gore basically said was, "I helped create the conditions that allowed the internet to happen." So if you imagine, this $15 million required Congress to say yes, right? Congress had to say yes to the $15 million that eventually funded the NSFNet. And I'm going to guess that Al Gore was one of the few people in Congress in 1982-83 that actually understood the significance of how important it was to say yes, even though those lobbyists in your office are telling you no, 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 no. And so I think we do owe Al Gore a bit of a debt of gratitude to the point where he helped get this $15 million through. It's a tiny amount of money if you think about it today, but it was so strategic to the future technology of our world. And frankly, it's a culture-changing moment. And all he's been is sadly teased about that, which I think we should really appreciate it. So the internet from 85 to 90 kind of came out of Michigan and all grew nationally and internationally. And so if you remember what Tim Berners-Lee said at the beginning is that the web revolution could only happen if a quieter underlying revolution happened before it. And that quieter underlying revolution was this spread of the internet. And of course, this wasn't just a United States thing. There's equally exciting stories of how the internet happened in Europe and Asia and South Africa and Africa. I mean, they're actually all fascinating stories. They're really great adventure stories. Everywhere was an adventure because no one understood why we had to do it except a few crazy, passionate individuals that understood if we connect people together, good things will happen. So we were trying to figure out a lot of things to do with this internet. And frankly, I was using it a lot during this time. We'd use it in this command line mode and typing little statements and sending files to each other and email and all text mode. And it was a really awesome thing. So in this environment of a fast internet, people start saying, what can we do with this internet? So now we go to CERN, the high energy physics facility that straddles Switzerland and France near Geneva, Switzerland. And so now we're going to meet one of the other co-inventors of the World Wide Web. His name is Robert Caillou. He is the less well-known inventor of the World Wide Web. And I met him at CERN in his office. And we talked a little bit about the beginning of the World Wide Web. So the thing I'll point out to you is, and we'll hit this again, is that they weren't building Farmville or Facebook. As a matter of fact, these were serious academic people. They almost thought that sort of entertainment use of the internet was wrong. This was a scarce resource, and we should be serious. We're going to use this to move academic papers back and forth between academics. And we're going to write some good documentation on how to write Fortran programs, because we are serious people and we are doing serious and important work. Some of the precursors to the web were a thing called HyperCard. HyperCard was this really cool thing that would give you these, like as a Rolodex cards, like a stack of cards, and it had these things where you could jump by clicking a button to any card in the stack. And so that's why they called it HyperCard. It was like cards with these hyperlinks to any card. So you could go through them sequentially if you wanted, flip, or you could just jump on this magic button and transport yourself instantly to anywhere in the deck. That's the notion of hyperlinking. And so the idea that they were trying to solve is the problem of creating editable hyperlinked documents using the internet. So CERN, if you ever get a chance, if you're ever in Geneva, Switzerland, I would greatly recommend that you swing by CERN. They have a really awesome public outreach program. They give tours. You can't go down into the detector anymore because once it started, it's radioactive and stays radioactive. But I was lucky enough to get a couple of tours, take my family down in the Large Hadron Collider that was featured in Angels and Demons. So yeah. So I had a little story. I almost ended up in the making of the Angels and Demons because I just showed up at the end and they were sort of doing some filming and I never ended up in it. But they filmed. We were standing doing a tour and this camera came down on a great crane and it panned around and then I was standing there with a hat on and the tour guide had a hat on and we were looking as cool as we could, thinking we would end up in the movie. So it turned out that at the bar later that night, I ended up singing the blues with another bunch of physicists. So you can go sing Dr. Chuck Sings the Blues and you can see this thing. That night, I was at the bar singing the blues with this blues band. That's all physicists. And at the bar, I was talking to one of the guys who was the boyfriend of one of the women in the blues band. And he was at the top when they were filming us. And I said, dude, I'm going to be in the movie making Angels and Demons. We'll just be like an extra, right? And he said, you're not going to be in the movie. He said, the reason, I was listening to him while they were talking when they were filming you, and he said, the reason they were filming you is they were just trying to figure out how tall humans were. Because they're going to put fake humans in there. You know, they're going to stick a human in. They just want to know how tall they are. And so that's why they point the camera at you, because you're not going to be in the movie. So, be that as, CERN is a lot of fun. CERN is like people from all over the world. All these physicists, they converge on this CERN thing and they party and they drink and they have coffee and they have wine on tap at lunch. It's if you're a physics major, stick with it and get a PhD and then like go to live in Switzerland. It's pretty damn cool. I mean, I call it summer camp for physicists and I love going there every time. And it's not surprising that something awesome like that comes out of a bunch of bright people who are just hanging out together and having coffee together. It's just this collection of some of the smartest people, physicists, in the world together. And so it's not surprising, it's not logical that they had to be the ones that invented, but it's not surprising that this bunch of really smart people with so many diverse perspectives were the ones that ultimately invented the World Wide Web.
So because we have this need for spreading documentation around, we build these things in like centralized databases. There's CERN block, you know, you could use it, but whatever. We have we still have a large database of energy physics articles kept by Stanford. And you could get at it before the web by knowing exactly what computer log into of the network, blah, 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 blah. When the web came on, that necessity of knowing which computer to go to, what to say to that computer, and so forth, just disappeared.
Do you tend to feel like this was the big one, or it was just...
in a sense, of course, as I always say, we called it World Wide Web in 1990, and Tim had, in fact, a name like that just before that. So there was, in fact, no way of building it smaller than the internet already was. The internet was everywhere. So there's no way you could build it smaller. But the thing that we probably did not expect or did not aim for, definitely, in the beginning, at least, was to have this be useful outside the community of academics and internet people that existed then. Gopher was simpler and easier to install and easier to populate. And that explained its easier success for a while, because both took off at about the same time. And because the web was somewhat more difficult, it took somewhat longer. But Gopher became also integrated in the web browsers almost instantaneously. And so, you know, after that, after a short while, you saw what you could do with the web, what you could do with Gopher, you went to the web. But it was easy, much easier to install Gopher. This is a very, which is why it had a sort of bump where it went ahead of the web for a while.
So this is the very first, sitting here is the very first web server. It's a Next workstation. Interestingly, Steve Jobs used to work at Apple. Well, he originally started at Apple. He created Apple, and he was the CEO of Apple when they were making sort of Apple IIs, then the early Macintoshes and Mac OS 8. And then Steve Jobs had a falling out with the board of directors, and they pissed him off, and so he quit. And he formed a company called Next. Said, I will come back and I will eat your lunch. I will compete with you. You think you're so damn smart. I will make a new company and I will kick your butt. Old company. And now Next wasn't all that amazingly successful. It was a very beautiful computer, very expensive, unfortunately. It did a lot of things really nicely. Steve Jobs eventually came back to Apple after Apple's board sort of realized that they were screwed without him. So they begged him to come back, and he fired all the people that pissed him off. And he brought back with him the operating system that came on this Next computer, which was a Unix-based operating system with a really beautiful user interface. Many of you have it sitting on your laps right now. It's called Mac OS X. So sometimes you will see a really weird error on your Macintosh that starts with a capital N, capital S, like NS domain failure. It usually means something really bad's happened. It's not a normal message. But if you see NS anywhere in it, it means next step, right? It is that very computer. Steve Jobs made this computer that made the internet happen. If Steve Jobs hadn't quit his job and made this computer, it's entirely possible the internet might never have happened. You also probably have next step in your pocket as well, because next step is the operating system. Well, Mac OS X is the operating system for the iPhone phones. And so again, we go back to sort of this moment where Steve Jobs invented this thing out of spite. One of the pieces of hardware ends up making the World Wide Web, and the first web browser only ran on NextStep, as we'll soon see. But it still lives today on your lap and in your pocket. So Steve Jobs, in some ways, could be credited with partially being responsible for the creation of the internet. So CERN built a worldwide set of servers and some software that allowed the worldwide creation and maintenance of documentation, papers, etc. So we've gone to Michigan to build the NSFNet, we've gone to CERN where they invented the web browser, and now we go to Stanford to talk about some of the first content on the internet. So this is Paul Koons. He works at Stanford Linear Accelerator, and you heard Robert mention the physics papers at Stanford. I like to think of this kind of as the first search engine or the first large publisher. Now, these physics papers existed long before the internet and the World Wide Web. So let's meet Paul.
Says, well, if you can query a help system on the mainframe, you can query a database on the mainframe. mean, did you write it from the protocol, or was there software that you used to make your first web server?
Well, I used the CERN server software, which is good in C. Unfortunately, we had a C compiler for the maker. It was December 12, 1991, we installed our web server. And we formed generously that day. The big boost came about a month later, in January, in southern France, and there was a workshop on computing topics for Einstein and nuclear physics. And at that workshop, Tim Berners-Lee had a plenary talk. So he gave his hour-long talk to about 200 physicists from around the world. And as part of his talk, he gave a demo. And at the very end, and most people, I think, were bored most of the time. The worst thing that software people want to think about is documentation, and he was mentioning documentation. But at the end of the talk, he connected to the Slack web server and made it work. And that really dropped a lot of jaws, because everybody knew the database. Everybody knew how hard it was to access. Okay. And here he just clicked away, typed in a few things, a query term, and bang, the results came back in the C formula. So, the way I said, the interest in the web went from about 20 people to 200 people in that hour. Okay. Now, those 200 people went back home, and if each one of them told 10 people, then within a week, the interest in the web grew to 2,000 people. So, that was a big turning point. And I think Tim recognized that that was really the kickoff.
So we kind of come back to the notion that what Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Caillou were building was an editable content system with links between documents stored on different servers. And it really wasn't all that exciting, frankly. This was kind of the first bit of useful content. Now all of a sudden you say, if I can use this tool to retrieve content, then it's a very different tool than if it's just a way to be a giant word processor for all humanity around the world. Not that a word processor for all humanity is a bad idea, it's just, it's not a step, amazing step forward. So that was kind of the first search engine. It was the first large source of content. It got the physicist interested, because as Paul says, the physicists in 1992 were not even interested in their own creation at this point in time, because it was just a word processor. So in 1993, this is 3 years after the web was created, Gopher was dominant. A thing, you can go Wikipedia Gopher, because it kind of doesn't exist anymore. There was a meeting of the engineers that run the internet, the IETF, and there was two BOFs, bird of a feather sessions. One was a Gopher BOF, a technology that you probably don't even know about, and there was 200 attendees and there was no room left in the room. And there was also a BOF about this thing called the World Wide Web, and Tim Berners-Lee was. And there were 15 people in the room. My co-host from the television show, Richard Wiggins, was in that room. And Tim Berners-Lee was almost in tears, because it looked like he'd done this thing for 3 years and he knew he had a cool technology, and yet everyone was ignoring the web in 1993. It was almost as if the web was about to die in 1993. And Gopher had all of the buzz. The same year that the DVD was invented, so that's a long time ago. Some of you probably weren't even born yet. So we've been to University of Michigan to build the internet. We went to CERN to invent the web. We went to Slack, Stanford Linear Accelerator, to do the first sort of real content on the internet. And now we're going to go back to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for the next thing. So the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign was another one of these kind of well-funded organizations, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. Larry Smarr, who you met earlier, was a genius at getting money. What's even more cool about Larry Smarr is he could get money for things that were easy to do, so they had lots of spare money left over. So they had a bunch of smart people in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, and they had the best network on the planet, they had the best hardware on the planet, and so they had a real different perspective of the world. And so they decided to build their own web browser. That web browser was called Mosaic. What's unique about Mosaic, it's the first web browser that worked on PCs, Macintoshes, and on Unix. Up to that point, it was very much a Unix system like Linux today. right? Up until that point, it was very much academics. I had an $11,000 workstation in the 90s, right? That's how much these things cost, and I could run this Unix software on my workstation. But normal people who had, you know, mere $3,000 or $4,000 PCs or Macs could not do so. So Mosaic became the first browser that ran on all these. But in addition to it being the first thing that ran on Windows and Macintoshes, it also had a very different perspective on the web. It changed the web from being an editable medium stored on multiple servers to being more of a consuming medium. So the notion that an image would be shown on the same page as some text was an innovation that Mosaic produced. Because if you're writing documentation, they wanted to have the pop-up windows for every image. So this little notion of your face on Facebook in the upper left-hand corner, the early internet did not do that. It might have a picture, but it was kind of like, this is an article about geography, and here's a beautiful map, and you pop the map up in a new window. The notion of putting the image on the same page, that just seemed like ludicrous. But at NCSA, they were changing and seeing this web as something that would we would be entertained by, that we would consume. And so they started adding features that made it less sort of a editor and more of a browser. So let's meet Joseph. Did I skip a slide? That's okay.
Web browser.
Oop, hang on.
NCSA was kind of a special place, right? One of those things that happens very infrequently where there's lots of energy, a large amount of resources, visionary leadership, and a lot of free space for people to play. Larry recognized from the beginning, and we all love the idea, that these small little things on the desktop were really the gateways for everybody to the big machines in the background. And that all of this would turn into one cloud behind the screen that we needed to figure out how to get the user involved as much as possible. So that's the context in which Dave Thompson pulled down one of the early web browsers. And it was the one from Slack. He went through the effort of getting it working and brought it in and showed it to Mark Andreessen. And both of us looked at the screen. Dave described what he had in front of us. And we said, we can do better than that. That's a complicated system, and the interface looks terrible. And Dave said there was a real pain for it, for him to get it working, for him to download it, install it, compile it, and everything. And it only works on the next Windows box. And wouldn't it be cool if it worked across all three of the boxes and if it was something that was just a plug and go like the rest of our tools? I remember an HP exec coming in one time, and Mark and Eric had written a little filter that took Unix documentation and made it into HTML and made all of the references into links. And they went through, they hit an HP site, and the exec said, where's this coming from? Because he was able to see all his HP documentation there in the room with NCSA, and that he threw a release link. He said, well, you've got three or four folks back there that have put up a HTTPE service. You may not know what those are yet. He said, I've never heard of this. And he said, but this is the kind of thing that is probably going to be really useful in the future for people who are trying to manage documentation in a distributed fashion. Yada, yada, yada. Right? Went on with a story like that, and this guy was bouncing up and down to see. And this was the kind of response that in 93, late 93, early 94, there's this full suite of mosaics that work across X Windows, the Mac, and the Windows system. And that's the point at which the guy who was the president at the time of the Internet Association said NCSA has fired a shot heard around the world because it's available now across all these platforms, and anybody can use it. And we saw, you know, an exponential growth in the number of HTTPD servers and the amount of traffic, yada, yada, yada. All that stuff that went on there. And Tim, of course, Tim Berners-Lee at this time, would say, well, he had seen an exponential growth from the very beginning. And he's right. We're both right.
So basically, when there was a browser on the inexpensive consumer platforms, then all of a sudden, the web became a consumer device. So we go from 1993, where Tim Berners-Lee is nearly crying in a meeting because no one seems to love his web, to 1994. 1994 was where it all exploded. Everything went crazy in 1994. Netscape was founded in 1994, that took the Mosaic software. First World Wide Web Conference. If you read Tim Berners-Lee's book, you'll find out why there were two World Wide Web Conferences. The folks from Illinois were fighting with the folks from CERN. In 1994, Tim Berners-Lee founded the World Wide Web Consortium, which is the standards organization that tried to get its hands on it. And in November 8, 1994, Windows 95 came out, which had a browser built into it from Windows. So this was a very scary and chaotic time, because it's kind of fun when just a few people are doing something and they're all cool researchers and you're wondering about what it is. When the market grabs something, you lose control. And so HTML, a lot of things in this whole thing were rather unformed, because they were just sort of a boutique little crazy thing that academics were using. So let's talk again to Robert Caillou again, and hear a little bit about sort of the environment, about HTML and what was wrong.
The interesting thing though is that I found HTML a glorious language. Now I'm not the average user, but I like to write it. I mean, I enjoy it. It's like tech.
Right. It's exactly as bad as tech. Right. That's exactly what it is. It's exactly as bad as tech. And can you imagine that the headings have levels which are absolute?
Sure. You plus.
Sure. Right. Come on. But HTML was, we just realized that we were never more than four people here. Tim and myself and a student each. Okay? So things like putting in serious effort into thinking about HTML was a low priority business, and then of course by the time there was time to do that, it had spread beyond repair.
So basically, sort of in the early days, we have sort of two professional people and two students working on the entire web for a couple of years. And so it was sort of a chaotic mess that exploded out, and a lot of things kind of went wrong at that point. So let's go revisit Joseph again and hear a little bit about that chaotic time from Joseph. Oh, not that one. Oh, we're about 1993, so I should have shown you this one. Sorry, I got out of order. I don't know why I'm out of order on this. So this is another of those commercials. And these commercials came out in 1993, before the web exploded onto the scene. And you will see the company that they come from as well. It's not Sears.
Have you ever renewed your driver's license? Had a cash machine?
Nice picture.
Fixed your car with a television?
You walk through that?
Move your right hand. Or had an assistant?
Here.
Who lived in your computer?
The reference material I've gathered for your 10 o'clock meeting, and I'm still working on those playoff tickets.
Oh boy.
You will. And the company that'll bring it to you, AT&T.
So basically, AT&T saw the future, but they saw a little different future than the future we have, right? They thought that AT&T would bring us everything. So, I'm running out of time. Let's get rid of that. Let's skip Joseph. So if we look at sort of the summary of what we've seen so far, Larry Smarr didn't want to create an internet. He just wanted supercomputers to be available to physicists around the world. University of Michigan snuck in a high-speed network where the AT&T folks had only approved a low-speed network. Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Caillou were building a distributed documentation system that not very many people actually found all that exciting. Frankly, it was almost dead by 1993. Paul Koons was only trying to make his article database a little easier for people to use. And Joseph Hardin was just trying to make supercomputers a little more friendly by building the Mosaic browsers. So these folks really were just sort of, I don't want to use the word hippies, but they kind of were hippies, right? They were just trying to make the world a better place. Oh, that's where I was supposed to show the AT&T thing. Hang on, I'm running out of time. Crap. Okay. So let's just say that these things didn't happen. Let's say that these hippies did not accomplish, without even intending sometimes, did not accomplish what they've accomplished. I think what we would find is we would find that AT&T would have won. We would have a single source for our personal computers. We would have a single source for our phones. We would have a single source for our network. There'd be like no free Wi-Fi. You would pay literally for every single thing that you ever had. And the innovation, of course, there would be no app store, right? AT&T would tell us how it's supposed to be. So the problem is that if you end up in a monopoly situation, innovation just doesn't happen. And we would have got these same innovations at the moment that AT&T could have made money off of it. So what happened, this is my last video, what happened after the 90s was a whole different kind of people came in. So the last person that we'll talk to is Jeff Bezos. Jeff is the founder of Amazon. And this was taped in 1997, where Jeff had just spoken to a small group of librarians at a library conference. And you will see Jeff talking about, and this is, remember, in 94, 3 years earlier, was the first time the average person even knew the internet existed. This is 3 years later, and Jeff Bezos has basically captured the notion of what becomes internet marketing that quickly. But you'll also notice that Jeff Bezos is younger, with a very different background and a very different affect than the other people that we've met so far.
Hi there, who are you?
I'm Jeff Bezos.
And what is your claim to fame?
I'm the founder of Amazon.com.
Where did you get an idea for Amazon.com?
Well, 3 years ago, I was in New York City working for a quantitative hedge fund when I came across the startling statistic that web usage was growing 2,300% a year. So I decided I would try and find a business plan that made sense in the context of that growth. And I picked books as the first best product to sell online, making a list of like 20 different products that you might be able to sell. And books were great as the first best, because books are incredibly unusual in one respect, and that is that there are more items in the book category than there are items in any other category by far. Music is number two. There are about 200,000 active music CDs in any other time. But in the book space, there are more than 3 million different books worldwide active in print at any given time across all languages. More than 1.5 million in English alone. So if you have that many items, you literally build a store online that couldn't exist any other way. And that's important right now because the web is still an infant technology. Basically right now, if you can do things using a more traditional method, you probably should do them using a more traditional method.
What kind of inventory do you keep?
We inventory the best-selling books. At any given time, we're inventorying in our own warehouse only a couple of thousand titles. And then we do almost-in-time inventory for another 400,000 titles or so. We get those from a network of order electronically from a network of wholesalers and distributors. We order those today. They're on our loading dock the next morning. Then for another 1.1 million titles, we get those directed to 20,000 different publishers. Doesn't take a couple of weeks to get.
So you see, like, Jeff Bezos is a business major, right? He sees it as an opportunity. He sees it as a way to make money and, frankly, change the world himself. I mean, so there's nothing wrong with making a bunch of money. So let's see. I'm running out of time. Oh, let's see. We'll skip these. I got some more videos. You'll get those. Oh, that's it. So thank you for your time. We finished sort of on time by skipping some stuff. Okay? Thank you.